I wanted to take a minute to relay two JFK researcher jokes. I don't know too many, but one is that two Secret Service agents walk into a bar, and one of them orders a Lee Harvey wallbanger, and the bartender says, "One shot or two?" The other I just heard last night, and a Kennedy researcher spends his whole life working on the case and dies and ends up going to heaven. And God comes to the gate and says, "Welcome to heaven." And he says, "Well, that's great," he said, "but I had a question." And God said, "Sure, a question what?" He says, "Could you tell me who killed Kennedy?" And God says, "I have a theory about that." So I recently spoke to a college student and mentioned the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. He asked me what he was known for. You know, we're passing into a new era, and the Kennedy assassination may seem to the current generation as some irrelevant, if interesting, historical tidbit, much as the Lincoln assassination seemed to my generation. In reality, both those assassinations had a national impact. They shifted paradigms of understanding, and they impacted major policies and political trends that followed them. And both of them ended a forward agenda that was being carried out by these leaders and the hope that they represented for social change in their times. And so I'd like to put the Kennedy assassination into its historical and political context so that we can understand why it matters 50 years later and what we can do about it. Years ago, an older black man sitting on a stoop in Washington, D.C. overheard me talking about the assassination. And he responded, "Kennedy, he dead." Well, indeed he is. But more died on November 22nd than the handsome and energetic president of the United States. Far more, in my view. This is James Madison in his Political Observations, 1795. He talks about a deep conviction of the danger to liberty and the Constitution from a gradual assumption or extension of discretionary powers in the executive departments from successive augmentations of a standing army and from the perpetuity and progression of public debts and taxes. Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, two, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Thomas Jefferson said, "I abhor war and imbue it as the greatest scourge of mankind." George Washington, in his farewell address, 1796, said, warning the country, to oppose foreign alliances, attachments, and intrigues, which would stimulate and embitter. Hence, likewise, they will avoid the necessity of those overgrown military establishments which, under any form of government, are inauspicious to liberty and which are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty. Hermann Göring at Nuremberg trials for war crimes said, naturally the common people don't want war. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. Whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship, voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. America, for most of its history, adhered to the founders' ideals and disbanded armies at the end of each conflict, but that ended after the massive militarization of World War II. The false patriotism used to garner support for wars of greed and conquest abroad began in earnest during World War I, and objectors then were attacked, beaten, and imprisoned. Some were killed. For most of its history, America did not have conscription, at least not between wars, but that ended with the passage of the Selective Service Act in 1940 to sort out the glut of volunteers and allow rotational training at camps. It's stayed in place until protests, objections, and resistance ended it in the early 1970s, so now we use a poverty draft or economic conscription much more efficiently to pit the poor and people of color against the same population in other countries. President Eisenhower, a decorated World War II combat general, in his farewell address in 1961 warned, until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But now we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense, so we've been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new to the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, and even spiritual, is felt in every city, every statehouse, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for the development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved, so is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the, and this is the first draft, military-industrial intelligence complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. With the inception of the Pentagon in 1948 and the National Security State in the same year under President Truman, these trends began in earnest. The Cold War sustained the lie for a need to continue the arms race and hostile foreign policies that included assassination and establishment of dictatorships, as well as an alliance with the Nazis that we considered enemies in World War II in the name of opposing communism. It provided a framework to crush labor unions and popular dissent in the 1950s. It led us into Vietnam and many other covert and overt wars abroad. It justified the huge military and intelligence budgets that cut into social services, human developments, and economic prosperity. America failed to heed Eisenhower's warning, and a huge armaments, aerospace, oil, land speculation economy grew in the Southern Rim, rising to power, in my view, on November 22, 1960, social services, human developments, and economic prosperity. America failed to heed Eisenhower's warning, and a huge armaments, aerospace, oil, land speculation economy grew in the Southern Rim, rising to power, in my view, on November 22, 1963, with the assassination of John F. Kennedy by a military coup d'etat. Kennedy was working at the time to end the Cold War, to reach detente and a lasting peace and cooperation in space with the Soviet Union. His June 10 talk, months before his death, to the graduating class at American University, laid out a path to peace that was then abandoned. He had saved the world from a nuclear holocaust during both the Bay of Pigs fiasco and the Cuban Missile Crisis when he communicated directly with Khrushchev instead of listening to General Curtis LeMay and other Joint Chiefs who wanted to go to global nuclear confrontation. LeMay stormed out of the Missile Crisis meeting saying, "We have to get rid of those sons of bitches," meaning the Kennedy brothers. Kennedy realized he had been lied to by the CIA and the Joint Chiefs in the Bay of Pigs matter when they tried to force his hand to bring U.S. air support to the rebel groups. He fired CIA directors, including Alan Dulles, Charles Cabell, Richard Bissell. Near the time of his death, Kennedy said he wanted to break the CIA into pieces and scatter them to the four winds. Dulles later sat on the Warren Commission and helped to cover up the real facts behind his death. The strategic interoperative plan for nuclear response attack would have led to long rows of B-52s flying over Russia and China, carpet bombing with Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. The atmosphere and life on the Earth would not have survived, for the most part, all over the globe. It has been recently revealed that there was a standing military order in the case of the assassination of American president by foreign, read communist, sources that just such a Holocaust would be immediately unleashed. It nearly was on November 22nd. Kennedy was also pulling out of Vietnam, ordering all U.S. troops removed by the end of 64, in April of 63, a policy completely reversed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff November 25th, planning instead a 10-year war with 57,000 American dead. Kennedy was supporting many international movements for independence against old colonial rule. He realized that making peaceful revolution impossible made violent revolution inevitable. Instead, his successors escalated existing wars, supported colonial repression, and armed dictators and fascists as anti-communist allies for decades. George Brown of Brown and Root financed the political career of Lyndon Johnson, and his company made $4 billion on the construction of Cameron Bay and other projects in Vietnam. Kennedy and his brother Robert were going after organized crime, rooting out mafia leaders and their organizations, while J. Edgar Hoover denied its very existence. They were also being moved by emerging civil rights movements and addressing the issue of race in America in the face of a century of replacing slavery with discrimination in education, hiring, and Jim Crow laws in the Southern Rim that did not want to change. Their support of Dr. Martin Luther King following the March on Washington enraged the racists. Robert was also assassinated before he could win the White House to follow his brother's policies and reopen an investigation into his case, since he rejected the Warren Commission's sloppy work and wanted to unearth the conspiracy responsible. On the domestic front, Kennedy stood up to the steel industry when they tried to fix prices and wages. He opposed the oil tax depletion allowance, which was $13 billion a year tax write-off for the industry, real money in 1963, which financed elections. Oil to this day gets tax breaks and drives the foreign policy and wars abroad for the most part. It is being replaced now by opium, a more lucrative project, 95% of which comes from a country called Afghanistan. Kennedy also wanted to normalize relations with Cuba and end another such confrontation with the Soviet Union, and had reached out to Castro at the time of his murder. Operation Northwoods, designed by the Pentagon and the CIA to create a traumatic incident that could plausibly be blamed on Castro and allow invasion of Cuba after the many assassination plots against Fidel, were strongly opposed by the Kennedy brothers. Kennedy fired Lyman Leminster when he brought back a revised version of Northwoods, having already rejected the idea. In my view, the Joint Chiefs then planned to implemented Northwoods on November 22nd, using the assassination of the Tronac incident and framing Oswald with a double, visiting the Soviet and Cuban embassies in Mexico City to link the murder to Castro. Troop transport planes were loaded on November 22 at major bases to invade Cuba, Navy SEALs stationed offshore waiting for the green light to find and kill Fidel. The Strategic Air Command bombers were disarmed by removing their code books on November 22nd, as well as preventing all secure communication between federal agencies, those lines, when Lee Harvey Oswald survived arrest and death in the Texas theater, becoming a talking head instead of a dead red who knew far too much from his own background with naval intelligence, the U-2 spy plane, and intelligence operations at home. The murders that followed of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy were for the same purpose, to extinguish public hope and organizing for ending militarism, racism, and poverty in the growing permanent war economy and the concentration of wealth in the last stages of monopoly capital. This is why these assassinations matter, because they define our current history and our political reality. They were meant to kill any hope for change in the war and money agenda. When the Cold War excuse was continued, the Cold War excuse for continued militarism was threatened by the Soviet Union and it collapsed, and the excuse collapsed, a new enemy had already been defined by these war makers. Terrorism, and so was the response, more war, an end to civil liberties, the rise of the fortress state. Since the attacks of September 11, 2001, the military, intelligence, and homeland security systems have grown out of proportion to the past or any other country, spending over $8 trillion as of last year and more each day. The resulting wars have cost nearly $3 trillion. These institutions have also been increasingly privatized. The authorization for the use of military force passed by Congress after the attacks, again before the war in Iraq, have been renewed annually with little or no debate or discussion, along with annual renewals of a state of emergency. Both of these have been used to vastly increase the powers of the executive branch and the warfare state, and they were given the, they were they were the excuse given for every violation of the constitutional rights and procedures of the Bush administration. When I worked on Capitol Hill for Representative Cynthia McKinney and as an intern for Representative Dennis Kucinich, I co-authored over 100 articles of impeachment based on violations of the oath of office, aggrandizement of executive powers, constitutional violations and breaches of international treaties, and the laws of war. They were each one sufficient to impeach had Congress wanted to act, and well documented. Sadly, the new president, Obama, continues to violate all of them and has in fact made some of the violations worse. This should not surprise us on one level, since after World War II, and especially after the Kennedy assassination, the hired guns have taken over the ranch and are holding the owners hostage. The presidents come and go. The Pentagon and the CIA sit and grow. Intelligence agencies determined the outcome of World War II and then began to determine who would lead countries around the world in its aftermath. The military and its contractors made sure that the profits of war would continue. Destabilization became the foreign policy of the United States for whole continents and regions and continues to this day. Most of you have heard of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. How many of you have heard of the DIA, the ONI, the NRO, the DISC? These agencies are larger, command more budget, and employ far more people than CIA and FBI combined. Without oversight or public scrutiny, for the most part, they carry out the foreign and domestic policies and repressions. The NRO, National Reconnaissance Organization, whose initials used to be secret, now the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the Eyes in the Sky, the ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, is the largest and oldest intelligence agency, and each branch of the military has its own. The DISC, the Defense Industrial Security Command, was set up to guard the atomic secrets of the Manhattan Project under General Leslie Groves. It is the largest domestic police force in the United States, but unknown to most of you. In fact, the creation of the first nuclear weapons at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, led to the creation of all these ills that we now face, including excessive secrecy, nationalization of security issues, increased power of the executive branch, special emergency powers, and the excuse for permanent war and armament. Read the book Bomb Power by Gary Wills. Of the 13 agencies in the intelligence community, 11 were always under the control of the DIA. The Defense Intelligence Agency, which also controls 85% of the intelligence budget in secret and always has. The so-called black budget hidden in Pentagon spreadsheets. Most of you have now heard of the NSA, the National Security Agency, the electronic ear because of revelations about warrantless wiretapping and illegal surveillance. They have always been under DIA. Even NASA, NASA carries out DIA projects over civilian priorities. Now all 13 agencies fall under a new Director of National Intelligence, the DNI, who you may have noticed is always a military officer. Domestic police forces have also been increasingly militarized. SWAT teams now carry out thousands of drug raids annually using excessive force, and local police use military weapons against the populace. Every major government agency now also has its own SWAT enforcement team, and they've been using them. ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Agency, has been brutal and runs secret prisons. This trend began with the use of military weapons and tactics under COINTELPRO and the Joint Task Force approach against the Black Panthers, the SLA at Wounded Knee, Waco, and the Move House in Philadelphia. Top Secret America by Dana Priest and William Arkin outlines the massive growth of privatized intelligence function, including farming out security clearances, which led in part to the Snowden situation. In Arkin's new book, American Coup, he outlines the role of continuity of government planning since World War II and the threat it poses now to democracy and the Constitution. The plans for nuclear war led to doomsday provisions. These grew into more elaborate plans that now link to natural disasters, mass protests or rebellion, outbreaks of disease. In the 1950s, the McCarran Act allowed indefinite detention in special camps of, quotes, anyone who might possibly be thinking of probably committing any act of espionage or sabotage against the United States or planning to overthrow the government. And they could be detained without access to habeas corpus or trial by judge or jury. 36 former Japanese confinement camps, abandoned military bases, and other sites were designated as security prisons for this purpose. 13 of them were opened up and prepared for service just before the Kent State shootings by National Guard units. The executive branch has renewed this power of suspending habeas corpus and effected many secret imprisonments and indefinite detentions in undisclosed locations, as well as illegal renditions away from justice since 9/11. Elaborate plans for martial law were developed. The Tom Charles Houston plan, revealed during the Watergate hearings, is a blueprint for much of our current excess. I suggest you go back and read it. A similar plan was hatched by Oliver North during Contragate, never revealed. The special protocols regarding continuity of government, which was declared on 9/11 and never publicly revoked, have been denied any congressional oversight or knowledge. Continuity of government effectively suspends the Constitution, picks an elite group under the Pentagon, FEMA, and the National Security Council, some executive branch and agency personnel, and a few members of Congress to run the country from an undisclosed location for the duration of the emergency. Some of you may recall the Washington Post headline, October of 2001, Shadow Government Operating in Secret. Cheney and Rumsfeld designed these plans during the Reagan years in response to the Church Committee. If they ever declare code red, over 150 federal authorities have shifted, all mail, media, and even highways come under direct military control. A special White House Crisis Management or Emergency Operations Unit creates the conditions for continuity of government. Congress is considered irrelevant in the planned scenarios, as are the rest of us, save for those targeted for detention camps. If the Capitol was a target and all of Congress died, official plans suggest there wouldn't be any need to replace them until the emergency, declared emergency, is over. The emergency of 9/11 has been renewed annually since then. FEMA held readiness exercises annually. Rex 84 was a martial law scenario, rounding up Salvadoran immigrants and U.S. citizens who might protest U.S. policies in those countries, as an example. All these involve martial law plans. FEMA currently has camps set up and plans for Operation Endgame, detention and mass deportation of millions of immigrants. Special militarized police forces are being trained for these operations. President George Herbert Walker Bush created a civilian reserve corps, recruited at gun shows to be deputized and armed in the case of emergencies here or abroad that required the National Guard units to be deployed, leaving local armories and anti-riot functions to these untrained volunteers after a week of training at a military base. They would have power to use lethal force. RAND Corporation studied the transition to counterterrorism in the 1980s with the Army War College and the response to each level, conventional weapons and bombs, chemical biological attacks, and nuclear weapons, escalated the clampdown, suspended the Constitution, put the military in control. Remember the military raids in Boston neighborhoods after the Marathon bombing? That is a planned response, not random. People, they're testing it. People say that in America, someone will always disagree and that someone will always talk and that it is impossible to keep anything secret. Well, I disagree. We carried on a 10-year covert war in Laos in complete secrecy, a bombing war in Laos in secrecy. But it is harder now with the internet and cell phones and mass communications to keep everything secret. The creation of the National Security State, the massive classification of secrecy powers given to the agencies and the military, led to an effective end to history. Our history has been stolen and buried from us, as well as our foreign policy and war crimes. President Obama's executive order of January 2009 demanded release of any files classified more than 25 years ago, and they'd be released immediately without further agency review. This has already been frustrated by a law that ostensibly protects nuclear secrets, but in fact slows the release of all other records. A National Declassification Center estimates that the order covered over 375 million pages, but estimates from others familiar with the real hidden archives come closer to a billion pages. At the same time, teams are going through previously declassified records since 9/11 and reclassifying them. An additional 15,000 printed pages a year are newly classified. The electronic and digital files are reaching the event horizon of a black hole. Every 18 months, another petabyte of these records are classified and locked away. A petabyte is a million gigabytes. The government could not afford to hire in the subsequent 18 months enough people to read a petabyte of data. So meta tags are being used at the point of classification so that computers can later do the declassification, if any. The National Records Center, part of the National Archives in Suitland, Maryland, houses primarily classified military records since World War II. They're housed in underground buildings, each of them an acre in size. There are 27 of them. Our history, literally buried and kept from us, and a people without a history is a conquered people. It is in this context that we need to put the current attacks on Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden, and many other whistleblowers. If not for veterans who told the truth when they returned home from Vietnam, we would never have known about the My Lai massacre of civilians or the many other systematic war crimes that marked that war and all modern war, which is now inherently genocidal since 94% of the casualties are civilians, ethnocidal, and ecocidal. The Obama administration has been worse for whistleblowers than even Bush was. They're invoking the Espionage Act against people exposing government waste, fraud, and corruption, and lying. Intelligence leaks, like out of the agencies, are exempt from whistleblower protections, which are minimal anyway. But until Manning's case, the government efforts in this regard, with their draconian sentences to make a scapegoat and send messages to others, have failed to get convictions. But it hasn't stopped them from trying. Vilification in the press, presidential statements about guilt before charges, much less trial, false assessments of the harm that's caused by revealing outrageous breaches of international laws of war and crimes against humanity. Bradley Manning was put in an open cage when he was arrested by the Army in Afghanistan, like gay men were in World War II, and then tortured in his cell at Quantico by the Marines. They're treating Snowden and Julian Assange and Bradley Manning like the Emmanuel Goldstein of 1984, the enemy of the state, with constant hate week propaganda against them. If you haven't read 1984 lately or ever, I recommend it for understanding where you live now. Read The Book of Revolution by Goldstein, which Julia reads aloud to Winston. It's a good description of the last stage of monopoly capital, when surplus is destroyed rather than distributed, and permanent war leads to a fascist totalitarian state. Winston later discovers that even the Book of Revolution was written by the party in charge of the state. His job is to put inconvenient truths, photos, and facts down a memory hole at the Ministry of Truth. Another employee, Sims, has the job of reducing the number of words in the dictionary to prevent thought crime, since without a word, there would be no concept. A few years from now, Winston, Sims says, we will not even be able to have this conversation. We are fast becoming post-literate, post-historical, and increasingly post-scientific and post-rational. Those who research and part the veil of lies to wake us up from the nightmare. In a time of universal deceit, Orwell said, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And Martin Schatz, in his book, History Will Not Absolve Us, says that the political paralysis in America is based on the fact that we are allowed to believe anything but to know nothing. If we cannot know, we cannot act. But even in the face of this, some of us speak the truth to power. Some of us make the demands that power will never concede without. As Frederick Douglass noted long ago, despite all of this, there is a tradition of democracy and freedom, a potential, and the tools of communication available that makes it possible to reverse these trends and create a way out of this morass of fear and lies and hopelessness that we are fed. We have more options than most people in the world to make a democracy a reality for all, not a code word for government control and what Buckminster Fuller in his last book called the gross universal cash heist. Vincent Salandria, an early critic of the Warren Commission, the official version of the Kennedy assassination, argues that the murder is not a mystery that cannot be solved in our lifetimes, but was instead meant to be transparent in its implication of the national security and warfare state. Our confusion and denial over five decades are based on what the acceptance of that reality means and what we are then responsible to do if we wish to live in a democracy or even a society based on law. But until we face it, we remain in the paralysis that Schatz has described. Once we do, however difficult it may seem, we can and must respond. Once we admit that our democracy and hope for the future has been stolen, we can work to take it back and confront the lies and the false values that we suffer from. Thomas Jefferson said, and Chris had it in his slideshow, that given the choice between a government without a newspaper and a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter. He understood that the flow of information is more central to the democratic process than the machinery used to carry out the popular will. Sadly, the two institutions central to this flow, education and the media, which were designed as commonwealth that belongs to all of us, have instead been corrupted and monopolized to serve corporate interests and the machinations of the intelligence and military disinformation and propaganda necessary to control public consent for their agendas. If we want democracy, we need to restore those commonwealths. They don't own the media like they own a mine. They only monopolize the bans that are issued by the FCC. Objectively, we now have the science, the knowledge, the resources to create a better world that can use sustainable energy and safe energy and agriculture to support all life on the planet, including other species, feed, clothe, house, and even transport and entertain everyone in the world if we distribute the surplus of the wealth instead of hoarding it. And we also have the technology and communication necessary to create real participatory direct democracy and translate informed public will into rational policies that can end injustice and the causes of war. In the 1980s, Bill Kelly and I founded the Committee for an Open Archives to release the JFK assassination files, which we saw as the next step in keeping the case alive. Oliver Stone's film generated the momentum, and the bills that we got introduced weren't moving in Congress, but that led to the JFK Records Act being passed when it came out in the film. COPA was formed in large part, our organization, to implement that act, and we now have over 5 million pages declassified, not all of them. So I think we need to continue to demand that all files be released. And I've also drafted and trying to get pushed in Congress and hope people will help with this with their representatives to the extent they represent you. I always draft a Martin Luther King Records Act to release all the files regarding Dr. King, including those church records that Rex Bradford showed aren't out yet on COINTELPRO and all this. But it hasn't moved yet, so we're pushing for a sponsor, and once it moves, it would also allow oversight of the JFK Act that it's based on. Another route would be, a possible route would be a petition for a courageous DA to treat JFK's murder as a cold case, collect new evidence, and convene a grand jury. A federal grand jury would require the FBI to be the investigative arm, but a local jury would not. I proposed this to the mayor of Dallas as a way to get the press and the world to forgive Dallas and get the catharsis that he really wants. Someone last night was suggesting perhaps a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, except I think that people come to those after they're taken out of power. And these people are still in power. So I don't know what the momentum would be outside of immunity. We are holding a moment of silence this year, and we did it. We're visible. And I think visibility on this issue makes a difference. I appeal to people everywhere to hold their own moment of silence and do, even if you can't get to COPA, wherever you are, to do that. And those efforts succeeded. We got out into the press and we were visible. And I'm working, as you know, to create this Museum of Hidden History in Washington, D.C., because that's the audience that we need to reach, not the choir, but just the people coming. And the fact that it's hidden is going to make people peek in the door to see what it is. Okay, so that's the hook, but we can get people in and teach them the real history that's hidden to them by this country and by their perspectives and all the different levels of how you look at history. By demanding a resolution of the Kennedy assassination through full release of records, a grand jury, or these processes, we could begin the process of reclaiming the past as well as our future, because we can know, we can act, and we can win, in my view. We persisted. They haven't knocked us out for all of their efforts. We're still winning in the public opinion. Leonard Cohen sings that love is the only engine of survival. Instead of alienation, lies, and fear that drive most of our lives, we could learn to adopt instead the goal of real human community. We could learn to live with each other, not at the expense of each other, and we could learn to love truth and find the courage to act on it. So I wanted to end with a quote that I like from Bob Dylan. In All Along the Watchtower. There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's so much confusion, I can't get no relief. The businessmen, they drink my wine, the plowmen dig my earth. But none of them along the line know what any of it is worth. Well, no need to get excited now, the thief, he kindly spoke. There are many of those among us who think that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that. And that is not our fate. So let us not speak falsely now. The hour is getting late. I wouldn't be here but for the early researchers and all of you, and you might not be in this building, but for me, and my machinations, but I think it's important that we come together and try to talk about what's real and what's left of democracy. I used to tell Penn out on the Knoll, you know, we may be all there is, but at least we hold up the flame out here, you know, for some kind of different country. And I wrote Penn once and said that I had read that dolphins who began to be captured by the Japanese when they were fishing for tuna, because dolphins follow tuna for, that's their, you know, what they eat. And in the past, the deep nets would come up, and the dolphins were smart enough, they'd get out of the net and swim out of the net before getting caught, that the tuna weren't all that bright. But then they started shallow netting, and so the net comes up before any of the fish can realize it, and the tuna are stuck, or the dolphin are stuck there with the tuna and no way to get out. And what they observed is that, knowing that the end is near, the dolphin began to swim in a vertical circle so that each one of them would have air until the end. And I told Penn that I thought if we were trapped in such a situation, he's the kind of human being that would swim in the circle and not grasp for all the oxygen to himself. But I think that's who we need to be to each other. And I do think that this monopolization of capital has forced us all to have a primarily economic relation to each other. But it's not a natural relation. The natural relation is human community and cooperation. That's what Gandhi said. He said the history of the world is told in the history of wars and conflicts. He said, but the real history of the world is the history of cooperation. That's how we survived. And we need to get back to forming real and trusting human communities on all different scales in order to break this game, because this game relies on our alienation and fear. And we can play a different game we can, you know, take out of it. And I also wanted to thank again all the volunteers, including especially my partner Marilyn Tenenhoff, who, you know, you wouldn't be sitting here without her, because I had a bad arm all, you know, all these months, and she really did the work. So thanks to her and to Joe Green and Randy and all the people who do tech work, Dave Starks, and all of you for supporting COPA and for coming out. We're going to try to go to Baylor. It seems that the conditions are okay for the bus to get down there. The storm's not supposed to hit till a little later. We'll leave Baylor early if we have to, if that's what the driver says, but I'm hoping we can go down there and have a dinner and see it. So those of you who got tickets, or if you want tickets now, we have some left for the Baylor bus. It leaves exactly at 2, so be back at the lobby at 2 o'clock, and we'll go down, because there's fun stuff to see. Yes. No, I'll put the speech up. I'm glad to do that. You know, I'm kind of discouraged. I mean, Jack Calhoun had gotten it stuck in something that somebody else gave him, and he found it and brought it back to me. I don't know how, what happened to it. But I was kind of discouraged, because I was hoping maybe the government came and stole it and that they'd open up a file, because it would be one file in there where they could get real information.